the Ezrat Nashim service. Okay, now, no one said to me, let's say a year later when it was very successful, Rabbi, that was astute, you did it right. You know, it was done just the way it should be done, and just the way our congregation, and blah, 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 and the women are holding the Torah, and that. Oh, of course, now some, we have a few conservative or more left. They say, who wants to leave with the new women? I want to leave with the men. Okay, so I understand that. See, so, but, so that problem didn't bother me, see? I didn't lose any sleep over it. I thought about it. I wrote about it. I talked about it. I got help from New York. My niece was very helpful, see? Well, she's active in she lives in Riverdale, New York City, at a very ritzy area up there. She's a psychiatric social worker. Her husband is a Dr. Gimple. He's a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Medieval Jewish History. It's they're a very intellectual couple. Anyway, I always enjoy love to talk. So, this problem is easily handled, I mean, comparatively. But such a foolish thing about a baklan, a bar mitzvah, that can rock the boat.
So, but there are some things that are very, that have given you a great deal of pleasure that you
have done. Obviously.
And what are, as you look back, what are some of the things that have given you pleasure?
Well, obviously, I like to think, have you ever read our, in fact, I'm going to give that to you too, the 100th anniversary book which we issued. You'll have to read that, and you'll see that obviously I have many, many things to be happy with and proud of. In other words, obviously, this new synagogue, the whole effort which we went ahead and bought. And now I'll give you some even details which don't come out clearly in the book, but for the history, it doesn't hurt. I'll take all this credit to myself. Harry Cohn, you know, was the rich guy, and Ogden Howard was in 5th and King. Our synagogue was on 6th in French. Harry Cohn, who was a very shrewd, capable businessman, if you know how he made his money and how he turned around the Ogden Howard establishment from nothing and became a millionaire concern, he would sit in the last row in 6th in French, and I was giving the drasha, or I did this, and I was davening, or he came to the kiddush and so on. Then after watching me maybe for 6 months, he invited me into his office, and we began talking together. And then we became very friendly. I might tell you, Harry Cohn told me, this is in the book, how he cried the first Shabbos. You know, he came from a very religious Litvak family. They all never worked in Shabbat. When he came and he worked in a factory, we had to work in Shabbos, and he cried. Oh, he couldn't make peace with himself. So he told me his whole background about himself and his father and mother and so on. Okay. Then he told me everything about what's taking place with Sadie's children, all the going intermarried, mixed marriage, okay. He said, and even he says, and Sam Killer, what's Sam Killer going to be? And I said, there's one boy, Bobby. Bobby, he says, Rabbi, I'm giving you in your hands. And I want you to save Bobby. Because if you're not going to save Bobby, he says, the whole thing is going under. All right. So I became friendly with Sam. Bobby was bar mitzvah in our synagogue, and Bobby studied with me.
Bobby was whose child?
That's Sam's child.
Okay.
See, Sam had 3 children.
Okay.
And I think Sadie had 4. Adam, 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I understand that all of Sadie's children have mixed marriages. And even, and also Sam's, anyway, this bothered him, bothered Harry Cohn very much. Anyway, so we worked along, everything was okay. And then, when Bobby was already 15 and he was coming, putting on Tallison's film and Millionaire Sunday morning, well, maybe I'm the Mashiach, look what I did. And so Harry Cohn told Sam to become active. Anyway, Sam became active. He became on our building committee. And then Sam got us the house in which Harry Cohn lived on Concord Avenue, across the street from that Galach, park, W. Park Huntington, that Lutheran Galach, a mumsa. So anyway, I had a whole story with him. Rabbi, what do you believe on interfaith and me, worship service, I'll tell you. So anyway, I got Sam. They took the house. The house sold for $60,000-$70,000. Sadie wanted to get the money to Beth Emmett. I and Sam and Harry said, we know it's going to our country. See, so we got the money here. And then he made the will. And then Sam also, because he was involved with me and his son, Sam then made it that the Associated Hebrew School, which went under, because Harry Cohen, in his will, had so much, let's say, a fourth for Associated Hebrew School, a fourth for Beth Emeth, a fourth for Adas Kodesh, mm-hmm. and a fourth for JCC. All right? Yeah, that's what he did. All right, now, when Associated Hebrew School went under, well, and by the way, why did it go under? Because Rabbi Gewurz organized the Adas Kodesh School, and none of the Adas Kodesh kids went. And then ultimately, all the so Birnbaum hated me why I did this, and ultimately, it disappeared. So Sam said, I said to Sam, who should get this, to inherit Associated? Well, he said, all right, Adas Kodesh deserves to get. So therefore, Adas Kodesh gets half, and it's a quarter and a quarter. So therefore, we have this big lump of money.
To this day, you get this.
We get a big lump of money. So anyway, Sadie knows it, and she hates them when she comes here. She knows she's giving us something which she doesn't want. She would rather give it to them. But of course, her father wrote it this way, and Sam, interpreting his father's will, because apparently he had the right to do this, that's what I accomplished. This institution, now I'm giving you the full truth, see, this institution could never function
without
those $35,000 a year which I brought into this building, into this
one. That's interesting. How about during the building,
yeah.
You once told me something about the parking, the problem with the parking.
Yes.
Do you remember?
Well, I told you how we solved it. We didn't say anything.
Yeah.
In other words, see.
Tell us about it.
Yes. See, some people thought that, hey, we're going to put up a chain and we're not going to have any parking. And others said, no, what do you mean? So I said, no, we'll park over here half and here. No. I said, look, why are you kidding yourself? You know very well that right now, 95% of the people don't live within walking distance. So therefore, how are they going to get here? So therefore, and in fact, if you're going to make problems, I say, like on Yom Kippur, if you're not going to even keep this place closed, I say, you're going to have here a hazard. The police are going to, they won't let you park out in the street. So if you, that's when Yom Kippur, they all come here. I say, you're going to keep this place closed because after Kol Nidre, they all get in their cars and drive out. I say, assuming you're going to close up the parking place, where are you going to put those cars? So anyway, with a lot of discussion and all that, they realized the best thing is to leave it alone. We never said you're allowed to park, and we never said you shouldn't park. We never said any of these things, and we never put up any chain, and just leave it alone. And of course, those who want to come, come. That's the way we solve the problem.
Just by not making an issue of it.
Make no issue.
Uh-huh.
I thought by defusing the whole thing would be the way to solve this particular problem, particularly when this is the nature of the congregation. Here's another interesting anecdote. There's this the Lubavitcher young man here, Rabbi Vogel, you know, is in town.
Yes.
So Rabbi Vogel, I've heard, is speaking to some people and trying to get them have a mechitza in Adas Kodesh. Well, I don't mix with this.
For the person who's typing this, the mechitza, do you want to tell them what
it is? Yeah, a mechitza means separation between the men and the women.
Right.
In the worship service. This goes back to the time of the Bet HaMikdash. In fact, that's where you get the word Ezrat Nashim. In the ancient temple, they had a certain higher level, which was called the Ezrat Nashim, and the lower level, near the Mizbeach, was called the Ezrat Anoshim. And so this separation of the sexes.
Men and the women.
When it goes back to the time of the Holy Temple. We don't know so much about the first temple, which Solomon built, but in the time of the Second Temple is where they have these terms, and it's mentioned in the Mishnah, there we know. So therefore, we know pretty sure, let's say, like, from 516, 516 down to 70 CE, that's the time that we're talking about. That's the Second Commonwealth, and that's the time when they had these things we were talking about, the Mechitza. Now, so this gentleman is a nice man, talks to people, so I asked some of them, so I say, so what do you say? They say, we tell. Who wants it? See, in other words, he thinks it may be a live issue for certain people. I suppose in New York it is a very live issue.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Soloveitchik condemned such a house of worship, and he said in on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, a person should not hear the sound of a shofar in such a house of worship where there is no mechitza. Mm. And this is a very severe condemnation, because the hearing of the shofar is obviously a commandment from God. That has commanded us. And the separation of the sexes is still not really clear if it is a mechitza, if it is from the Torah. We know it's obviously midarabanan, the rabbis maybe, but we don't know. So the scholars haven't agreed, even the Orthodox scholars recognize that the mechitza is not really a inyan midoraita. It's not from the Torah. So therefore, it's not from God. But, of course, by the way, in itself, it's a hallowed practice. Yeah. And for a lot of religious people, that's sufficient. You don't need the other. But nevertheless, if you weigh one against the other. So Soloveitchik said that this, not worshiping in a synagogue where men and women are not separated, he said, even if it is not even midoraita, even though it's not from God, he said, nevertheless, you should not hear the shofar, which obviously is from God. It's a divine command.
Many changes are beginning to happen, not only in Ahavas Kodesh, but all over the country. And so what is your role now? At one time, you know, you were probably more conservative, and now there is a change. And how does this, are you able to make peace with this?
Well, I'm not more conservative or less conservative, I'm not more Orthodox or less Orthodox. I am more or less the same thing that I've always been. I think at the age of about 22, 23, I became a socialist, and still am. Regardless of Reagan or what other people say, I still believe in what I believe and how I think the economy of this country will have to help. And obviously, in 6 years, you double $1 trillion in debt. Surely that foolish man in the White House cannot say that his economics is the right economics. Now, I think that a lot, like, let's see, Simon, on the Democratic ticket from Illinois, others, and they also realize how you can build a country and build an economy. Ultimately, it's not a question of saying you confiscate everything and you give it back to all the people. No. So therefore, I still think that to me, socialism does not mean I'm a doctrinaire socialist. I only use socialism as a whip or as a vehicle to criticize what I think is wrong. It enables me to stand on my posture and say, this is wrong about the economy, this is wrong about the sociology, this is wrong even about the religion. Mm-hmm. So having a certain religious point of view, a socialistic point of view, to me is not an action point of view. It is primarily a cultural, ethical concept by which I can criticize and view society. Now back to them, to orthodoxy and to conservative reform. See, I believe in orthodoxy mostly because I believe it is the Torah point of view. And I believe that the Torah point of view is the Jewish way to view the universe. Now I know very well that things change here and there. I'd say, like I mentioned before, the Professor Efros and Sadia Gaon, correct. But you need then these primary sources by which to examine ourselves and society. I still have not changed in that. But you'll want to take a detail about, will women sit together? Well, when I came here, they sat together in Ahavas Kodesh. You come here, we say, well, women have to read the Torah, and so on with the Ezrat Nashim thing. Well, maybe that is somewhat of a change, but I never really was against that. See, so I think, I hate to say that I don't change, but I think, see, there's a certain very famous passage by Aristotle. He said, only fools keep changing their thoughts. I don't remember exactly. So in other words, if you have an idea, see, Aristotle, or let me put it this way. I had a professor in the University of Chicago who said, humanity is divided into two kinds of people. Aristotelians and Platonists. So therefore, either you're an Aristotelian or a Platonist. Now, if you're an Aristotelian, you're going to view nature, people, and from the structural way that if you're a Platonist, you're going to view it this way. The same thing here. A Platonist doesn't change. He evolves maybe with the situation. Get my point?
Yes, so that's your philosophy. You, from your early socialist background.
Yes. Religious Torah background.
And your religious Torah, it's been your umbrella.
Yes,
into
yes.
Into every field.
Yes.
That you feel.
Umbrella, even more. It's a foundation.
Uh-huh. I know you've done some printing. You've done writing.
Yes.
And we have some books that have been published. Can you tell us what motivated you into each of the directions that you went?
Well, because I was thinking and I was teaching, I thought that, especially, by the way, when I wrote that first book, The Authentic Jew and His Judaism, the Sartrean term of authentic, I read Sartre, the Jew and the Anti-Semite, a long time ago, and I read Sartre's book, and I read his notion of authentic, and then I saw how this guy, he has a very, very good insight into the Jewish situation. So, of course, I began to think about along other ways, and then I saw that what Sartre had something to say to me, I spelled out now for other Jews to read. I don't know if the average Jew who reads Sartre would see it, but Sartre doesn't discuss it, all the things that I did. Anyway, so therefore I thought that it would be some contribution for those people who would read this, and it would influence them. I know at the time when it was published, the HUC in Cincinnati was shaken by it, because I offered them, they saw here's an Orthodox point of view, which was not a doctrinaire, You believe? Ani ma'amin, Rambam. Ani ma'amin be'munah shleima b'viat ha-Mashiach. It's not a question of ani ma'amin. I didn't start that way. I started out with, what is authentic, what's not authentic, and so on. And then I come up with these interesting Orthodox point of view. So this tickled them, and they had to deal with it. Well, I suppose the fellows in Meir Shearim, they don't need this. If a guy in Meir Shearim is really religious, he doesn't need this stuff. So in fact, the guy in Meir Shearim doesn't even need the Rambam. The Rambam's guy to the perplexed, is more than welcome. They just need the Rambam's halakha. So it all depends. So now, those people who need something to help them think, and so on, I noticed that I told Nissen that what he's writing now the last 6 months is very good, because he's explaining, like even the Mishnah Gomel, Chasadim Tovim, Misha Gemalani Kol Tov, the Bracha Birchat HaGomel, Gemel Benchin. He's explaining to a lot of people the simplicities of Judaism, the basic thoughts which they somehow dismissed and never even entertained them. But explaining them in that fashion, this will open the minds of those people who are seeking. Now again, the Meir Shearim don't need this and Finkelstein to tell them. They all know about Gemel Benchin. But for those people who don't know Gemel Benchin, then you need a proper modern explanation where it will be meaningful for those people. And then this can open up within them a whole outlook on life, and they'll become religious and so forth and so on.
And so
that's what I had in mind.
Yes, motivated you. Teaching has always been a love of yours, hasn't it?
Yes.
Would you like to tell us?
I love to teach. You see that over there? That's from, that's not from your daughter. That's from Chaitin.
Yes, right.
But she's played a lawyer.
Right.
Now, I taught at Gratz Hebrew High School 12 years. I love it. I loved the whole time I was there. It was a lot of hard work. And when I teach, I don't sit down. I run around just like Gratz. And we were always active, and it was a tremendous satisfaction, because I was teaching things that I believed. So I would say that teaching is even more important, to me, the most important work in the rabbit, is teaching.
And so that helps the young people become the Jews of tomorrow and today.
I hope.
Right, right. What about you're going to retire now.
Yes.
And you must have some plans about your future.
Well, we were thinking about those things. You already heard me say that I want to write a book called Socialism Minatera. I am reading, and I'm going to come along, and I'm going to interpret Rav Kook in process philosophy, because I think Rav Kook goes into the Zohar, and the Zohar is Platonic, and Platonic is process philosophy. So I'm going to write something on Ralph Cook and so on. So on that, you know, I translated something, but I'm going to do more of that. So I hope to do these two little projects, and I suppose I'll be doing that in the next during the next 2, 3, 4 years. And of course, I'll the most important thing right now. Gladys and I, unfortunately, we're in the poorest congregation of the city. Although some say that, I used to say to certain people, yeah, they're not so poor, Gladys. The machen's a poor. The machen's a poor. Okay. But anyway, I never had a sabbatical. Never had a sabbatical. So maybe they were afraid, they were foreseeing that I would pull a Geffen on them. So
they're afraid you wouldn't come back.
You wouldn't come back. I couldn't run away. Okay, maybe. Hey, I'm joking on that. Obviously, I was going to come back. Anyway, we want to visit some of the things in museums, the art museums. They want us into the orchestras. Gladys and I have our big hobby is to listen to, in the summertime in Tanglewood, we go 2-3 times to the symphony orchestra there in Boston, and Ozawa is over there, and then we go to Rostropovich in Washington. So what a poor parson can do, we manage to listen to the, in Philadelphia we go to Mucci. So we listen to the orchestras here in the area, and of course we visit the museums, we always go on all these exhibitions, we try to sneak away. So we would like to go to some of the London we haven't seen, France, so many things. I want to see the Sistine Chapel. I'm dying to see the Sistine Chapel.
Well, so, I certainly hope to get there.
So these are the things we hope to do starting in October, November. And then we're going to stay 3 months in Yerushalayim with our son, daughter-in-law, and Einikel.
Oh.
He's ready, 18, 19 months now, a husky little lad.
And you're ready.
Yes. So we're going to go
there. One of the things you mentioned, Otis Kodesh as being poor, but actually the Orthodox movement is the numbers are increasing, and Otis Kodesh numbers are increasing.
Yes.
And you have lots of young people.
Yes.
Certainly, you want to take some credit for that, don't you?
Oh, definitely. I said, I didn't tell you before. Here are the things I built: the synagogue. I established a Talmud Torah. When I came here, there was no Talmud Torah. I established a Talmud Torah. I kept the minyanim. We are the only city, the only in the synagogue in the city where we have 25, 30 boys coming Sunday morning, 1,000 for the last 40 years. So these are the three big. Then my adult education, nothing new. I think Rabbi Kraft was always very devoted to it, and of course Rabbi Drews. So I'm sure, and today the Cohen and Grumbacher, I'm sure. So I'm not original on that, but that's a very big hobby with me. But and then of course we talked. Many people don't know about how Gratz was falling apart. Only just a few years ago, they were saying that we will close down Gratz and let Gratz meet in Philadelphia. There's no need to, they don't have enough children here and all that. And look what happened in the last few years. So I think Gladys more than I, but I also deserve a lot of credit for what happened. And then Mrs. Friedberg is wonderful. She's a very able diplomatic person. So now we have 65 kids.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We never had this. Then it used to be about 5 suburban, Gratz high schools attached to the mother, Gratz and Philadelphia. Today I think there's only one now.
It's
only
yours.
The only one left. No more. All the others fizzled out, couldn't hold, and we have today 60 kids.
Yes, well, I'm sure both you and Gratz's teaching has helped hold people here. I've heard that those reports. What about your Christian and community ties?
Well,
since you've been here,
yes, I've had different periods swinging back and forth, and I didn't care to be a fifth wheel to the wagon. a fifth and lotsam vav. In other words, if Rabbi Kraft or Rabbi Drews were very busy and active in Conference of Christians and Jews, I remember two years I was there, but I wasn't necessary. And whatever the benefits of that and the necessities and contributions of that organization, I wasn't really necessary. So I left that, and I went into different areas, which I picked up for myself and it worked for them. For instance, the fourth, fifth year, there was, there was a Baptist Galach here who was also very liberal and worried about poverty. So I latched down with him and I did some work with him. And so I was also president after 7-8 years in town of the Conference for Christian and Jewish Social Ethics. It wasn't a big organization, it was a very small group, but it was interested in these ethical concerns in different parts of the city. So I was there and here. In fact, there was, she's from Bethlehem, but she was on a school committee. Anyway, so I worked with her and others, and as I said, this was not a prestigious kind of activity, because their dinners didn't take place at the Hotel DuPont, and it was always done, we met in a church, or we met somewhere, and I managed to be there, and we helped out and so on. Then, recently, I got in contact with the Council of Churches, and I asked them, what do you have now, let's see, for the homeless? What do you have now for this? All right, so they tell me, and I say, all right, I would like to be part of this. So I'm not. You see, I'm not in the mainstream.
But you've separated.
But I know there's no need for me in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
See? In other words, if Grumbacher makes a invocation prayer there in Dover for whatever it is, very nice. I mean, it's very nice. It's a symbolic of certain things. But so what? I mean, he comes home and he goes home. And so in other words, it's a very establishment-like activity. And in fact, I don't know that. I don't know if they are improving their relationships with the Jews there in Dover or they're not. See, in other words, I think it's a pure formality where I'm not criticizing it. I think maybe it's necessary. To some extent, it's necessary. It's symbolic. So maybe other people will go beyond. Maybe someone will sit there to himself and say, all right, so we had Rabbi Grumbacher here. So what? I mean, so what are we doing? I mean, what about this anti-Semitism there in this public school over there down in another hick there in Selbyville? What about this over there? What about this thing about Jews over there? Or maybe they burnt a cross somewhere. See, this nice activity is a very wholesome thing, but it doesn't do anything to the nature of our social relationships and society. And it surely doesn't change the prejudice that is in our minds. It's a nice, formal, kind way, Okay, so I, therefore, call up this fellow, and I'm working with Romo, Reverend Romo, and he'll ask for some money, I'll give him $100. How much can I see? I can't tell the Federation to give him anyway, because
right.
I know the Federation says they have a more important one. So I'll give him my rabbi's charity fund, I'll give him $100, and so forth and so on. Maybe I'll make a personal donation of him, abyssal. But anyway, this is my method of operation.
Uh-huh, that's very interesting. One of the things that you told me once, when I commended you for helping keep the Jewish community in Wilmington as a unity, was your reasons for doing this. Do you remember talking? I said you're to be congratulated for helping do this.
Yes. I am a strong believer in the unity of the Jewish people. Unfortunately, now maybe the Orthodox ought to be the blame. I don't know. I think maybe more the Reform ought to be the blame. There's a Hakimachanik about pluralism. And I don't think there's clarity of thought here. I'm not going to take time on this now. It needs clarity of thought on this. But I believe, therefore, that the community should stay together, hold together, and work together. The Hadassah magazine, I think 2 months ago, had a very fine article on Rabbi Dr. She'er Yashuv Cohen, who was the chief rabbi of Haifa. I don't know if you read it. He's a wonderful man. I know him, I know him personally. He was the Masada Kedushin. He married my son and daughter-in-law in Yerushalayim 8 years ago when they were married. So I know him from a lot of contacts and with his father. I'll tell you, this is interesting about him. Aramet, this Rabbi She'er Yashuv, who's today the chief rabbi of Haifa. I got on the subway somewhere in New York City, Times Square, going to 57th Street, short little jaunt, and then he's standing over there. And I'm not going to see, it's crowded, so I stand next to the post. And hold on, I take out my book, and I'm reading something by Rav Kook. It's called Orot HaTshuva, The Lights of Repentance. And I'm reading this, right? There's this gentleman, see, a nice, tall, dignified gentleman, looks at me, and he says, Atokovei Rav Kook. So I say, what is your name? So he tells me, Rabbi She'er Yashuv Cohen. You are She'er Yashuv Cohen? The son of the Nazir? He says, yes. He says, how do you know the Nazir? So I say, well, I read about your father, and I know your father's relationship with Rav Kook. And he says, he can't get over it. He says, can you beat that? You're in a subway? I need a person who knows the intimacy of my life. So I said, well, you know the intimacy of my life. Well, we got off. Anyway, and we talked. So then I told him who I was. Anyway, then he told me that in 1948, he fought, and he was a yeshiva bach. In 1948, he fought in the army. He didn't want to any they say draft. He didn't want not being drafted. So he went in, and he was wounded in his hip. Began to heal, and about 2 years later, the doctors told him it's bad. A bone was fractured. And you need a new metal clamp over there, and it's a very serious thing. We can't do it here in Israel. You have to go to New York. Well, he goes to New York. So, all right. So he goes to his father. Where should you go? He says, well, go to see Solomon Kirsten. That's my wife's father. Go to see Solomon Kirsten. So he came here, this is 1948. He goes to see Solomon Kirsten, Mr. Kirsten, and anyway, talking. Well, he called a certain person, anyway, who he was, and they didn't know him. Anyway, he made the arrangements, and he had a surgery. They didn't charge him a penny, and he was well, and now he walks. He's 6 feet one, very presentable looking person. He was a captain in the Israel Army. Now this person, see, that he is the guy who they read about in the Hadassah magazine, which you have to read, on his way of bringing about unity in his city. So he tells the people, there's those people who want to throw rocks, he doesn't let them throw rocks. He says, what do you want? You want to daven? And he said, well, those people, so he talks to those people, don't make the movie house over here where these religious people are, make the movie house over there where everybody's irreligious. So you won't rub them and they won't rub you. And then he tells them, look, you're living over here, what difference does it make to you if they go to movies? He says, they're not religious anyway. See, what, you can throw them out of it, you're not Jews. So he convinced the various factions, and he told them, this is your turf, this is your turf, this is your turf, and now it's peace.
And so that's been your philosophy?
Right. So in other words, I believe that, now there'll only be one area, which is this cannot be resolved, the reform in America do not resolve it, but the reform in England and the reform in France have resolved it. What is? It has to do with divorce. Because if you're not going to have a divorce, and the woman remarries again, it's a mumser. See? That's simple. So therefore, the reform Jews in London and the reform Jews in France, let's say there are 50,000, 60,000, there are 500,000 Jews in England. So 50,000-60,000 are Reform. Of course, they're smaller than here. And the same thing in France. France has also a big population came up from Morocco and so on, and they're all Orthodox. But you have 100,000, the Jews are not Orthodox in France. So they've agreed. On the matter of get, see, on the matter of get, you will use the best. And they've convinced each other, if you have a best in a 5-6 Orthodox rabbi, invite one Reform rabbi just for courtesy. He's not going to mix in. Or he's going to sit there. Let him sit. So give him courtesy to show that you respect him. So if one of their people come for a get, at least he doesn't have strange faces. He has a Reform rabbi. He says, hey, Yankel, sit over here. So that's what they do in London, and that's what they do in France. Now, what about then get? Then you have conversion. So how do they do conversion? Each one gets converted by his own way. But who makes the conversion, it's again only the Beth. That means that the Beth then must accept the procedure of the Reform conversion, which they do. They accept the procedure of the Reform conversion. So now, let's see, what about bris? Well, I suppose they have to have bris. So in other words, the British Reform, they're what they call progressive, and the French progressive say they're doing this because if they're going to go to Israel, well, then they're not going to fight City Hall. The Israel rabbinate is establishment and it's Orthodox. So you have to be agreeable to them, and that's what they're willing to do. Now, this here is not so. Right here, that's why I don't know how it's going to be resolved. I see it right this way. If the Reform in this country are a million strong and they are raising, we'll say, $200 million out of the $500 million. So they say, we want $200 million attention for the money we're giving to UJA. You can't tell us to keep your mouth shut and we're going to go to Israel. No, we want $200 million attention. And therefore, we want our institutions in Israel to get 4, 5, 6, 7 million. Well, if we're giving you $200 million, why can't you give us 5, 6, 7 million? I say, yes, why not? But some Orthodox say no. Of course, they lost. And now they're going to get. Well, now, but the thing is, once they're getting it now, the question is, I think, see, here's another thing which I'm paying. Why is it that the local Reform people why don't they present now a resolution to the local federation to say that the original, 10% up front is abolished? They don't need it anymore. They weren't getting any money from UJ, UPA, okay. But now they're getting, what is it, 5, 6, 7 million? So why do they need the 10% up front? I had a long discussion with Nissen about it. I said, why can't they be honest and decent enough to say, they're getting their money, so why can't you abolish that rule? You push the rule. Nissen voted against it. He was very upset by it, but okay, they did it. So I said to him, but Nissen, now why can't they abolish it? I thought, ask him, why shouldn't they abolish it now? Okay, anyway, so in other words, I think in the long run, we will be able to get along for the purpose of unity. See, the very Orthodox bunch in Israel and the irreligious ones, they get along. I mean, they're not going to get married with each other.
No, but they're not fighting.
They're not fighting with each other. Right. See, of course, though, and by the way, those who throw rocks, that's not the main establishment. The what they call the Mavdal, the Mifleged Dati Lumi, the religious Zionists. The religious Zionists have lived with the labor rights since 1948. They all.
Yes.
And Cook wanted it that way. We always got along.
Well, thank you for speaking with us.
Yes.
And we hope that we wish you lots of luck in your retirement.
Amen. And stay healthy.
Stay healthy.
Amen. Thank you, sir. That's the most important thing.